Good morning. Let's see, this is August 24th, Sunday, and we are looking at some of the early books. There's a quote here from Joel Goldsmith I like. When asked, he said, "I have suggested those new to the message begin with living the infinite way, so as to gain some knowledge of the basic principles." And we looked at the chapter from Living the Infinite Way a couple of weeks ago. From there, they should go to a study of practicing the presence, and we looked at that last week. Once a student begins to be aware of the presence and to witness the effect of this awareness, more and more there comes an inner quiet that prepares him for a study of the art of meditation, which we'll look at today. When some proficiency in meditation has been attained, the student is prepared for serious study and practice, and is now ready for the art of spiritual healing, the infinite way, and so on and so forth. In other words, all the rest of the books, including Thunder of Silence, Beyond Words and Thoughts, Apprentices in Eternity, and on. So today we're looking at the art of meditation, and we are noticing that even in these early books, Joel laid it out. He couldn't hide it. It was in his consciousness, and he was living it. He was aware of it. Joel is laying out how to die to a personal sense of life and come into the awareness of beholding the impersonal living itself, the impersonal Christ. In other words, coming into Paul's recognition, "I live, yet not I, Christ liveth in me." That's the recognition of an impersonal self. And it's here in his early works. Now, I did not pick today's chapter. The chapter that I thought might be good, I just couldn't connect with it. It just did not feel right. So, after a meditation, this is the one that was whispered in my ear. And it's chapter 16, and it's called The Fruit of the Spirit. It starts with, "In the life of every seeker after God, there comes a time when he feels the presence and becomes aware in one way or another of an actual transcendental presence and power. Then he will have done with reading books about the God experience or with hearing people talk about it. We do not know in what form that experience will come to us. To each one it comes in a different way. But when it comes and the Spirit of the Lord is a realized presence, there is liberty. Freedom from fears, doubts, cares, and problems. The very moment that the Spirit of the Lord touches a person, he is transformed." Now, when he says, "When it comes and the Spirit is a realized presence," and so we need to talk about that. What does he mean by that? Well, I think you know, everybody knows by now, from the 1955 Kailua Study Series, it was necessary to not be content with part one of meditation, which is where we perhaps rehearse within ourselves, maybe in our mind's eye, a scripture or a truth. No, we must continue on to the second part of meditation, in which we have that quiet period. We listen, we're receptive, as I did this morning, to find out which chapter we would look at in this book today. We are receptive, we are listening, we are waiting upon the Lord within us. We're waiting upon that impersonal Christ self. Call it by any name, it doesn't matter. If you wait upon it, it will take over. It will direct you. And that's what this chapter is about. So, the most important part of the meditation is not the part where you rehearse truth in your mind intellectually. That's the letter. When all that comes to a stop and you wait, then is when the transcendental presence can be felt and you can become aware of it. And he says in the Kalua Study Series to wait for a minute or two or three and then get up so it doesn't become a mental exercise. You see, you can start mentally to know truth after you've been quiet for a period of time and convince yourself that that's the spirit, but it's not. It's still the mind. No, when you are still, really still, and there's an absence of self, which is true silence, then you have the awareness of something moving, something ising. And you know it when it happens. Nobody has to tell you. It's quite different from anything mental. So he says here, the very moment that the Spirit of the Lord touches a person, he is transformed. Sometimes, in the very beginning, it may become evident in negative appearances. Loss often precedes gain. He that loses his life shall find it. The present sense of life must be sacrificed that the spiritual sense of life may be gained. Before the full and complete realization of this new life has taken place, the breaking up of the old forms may appear as a problem of some sort. Economic, emotional, physical. There is a sense of losing something, giving up or sacrificing something, but actually this is not true. Once the Spirit of the Lord has really touched a person, he is not disturbed or affected by outer appearances. When the Spirit of the Lord really has touched one, he understands in reality nothing is being given up, lost, or sacrificed. So, the best example I have of this in my own experience, my own life, is when I started on this journey, and actually this book in my hand here, The Art of Meditation, helped me get through it. I started on this journey, and the wife that I had had for 4 years announced that she was leaving. And she took the baby and she left. And there was intense grieving. Definitely the feeling of losing or giving something up. And I recognized that I would never have a normal human life. That was not my path. And that too was a sense of loss. The loss of the belief, the vision, the universal belief, the emotional belief that I would find the right person for me and settle down and have a normal, married human life. That was never to be. And interestingly enough, 25 years ago, that's exactly what happened. I didn't have a normal human life, but I did meet the right person. And I like it better to say the right person showed up or appeared. We've been together for 25 years, and it's perfect. No, she's not perfect. I'm not perfect, but she's perfect for me. But at this time in my life, when I was first starting out on this path, it was a great sacrifice to give up the belief that I would ever have a normal human life, human marriage, human children, anything. I had to let it go, all of it. And it felt like a big sacrifice. But what came out of that, on the other side of that surrender, I became consciously aware of the living presence inside of everyone and everything, constantly, 24 hours a day. And so intense was it, I lost sight of this woman that I had to give up, because I was blinded, like Paul, on the road to Damascus, I was blinded by the light of God, and I absolutely fell in love with God and God's presence, which later I came to see as my very own being. But that's another story. Now, so that's what he's talking about. Sometimes loss precedes gain. And so at the very beginning, when you first decide, you know, I like these spiritual principles, I'm going to practice them until I find this presence he talks about, then you may go through a period of negative appearances. So he says, to a person who has even glimpsed the nature of the spiritual path, to one who has experienced the Christ, what is gained more than compensates for that which has been given up. And that's what I just said. Now, on the next page, he says, in this life, it is all highlands and lowlands, all mountains and valleys. Some days we look out on the world from the top of a pretty little hill, and all the world is gentle and kind. But before we know it, we have slipped down into the valley. There are other days when we are way up on top of the highest mountain, only to find ourselves the following day giving way to discouragement and even despair. These periods have no particular significance and are of no real importance. You see, with this back and forth and this pairs of opposites that we swing between like a pendulum, they have no real importance. There is always a valley between two mountains. One cannot ascend the next mountain without first passing through the valley. Ah, so now if there is an importance, here it is. It is in the valley that he casts off the burden of the human self with its desires, wants, and wishes. Thus, unencumbered, he is free to climb the next higher mountain. As the journey continues, the mountain experiences will be of longer duration, and the valley experiences shorter. And this will go on year after year until a point of transition is reached, when the heights remain his permanent dwelling place. And what does that mean? I can tell you from my own experience that I had many mountaintop experiences, feeling completely one with God, one with the universe, one with all living, all life. But then I slid down into the valley where I felt depressed and discouraged. Why? Because, as he said, there was still a human sense of living, a human sense of self. And in the valley, I discovered each time which part of personal sense I had yet to give up. I would discover each time, oh, there it is. Personal sense of self trying to exercise itself with ambition, and it didn't come about. Now he's depressed. Or personal sense of self tried to prove that it could do something spiritually when it's only the invisible Christ. I of myself am nothing. Or a personal sense of self angry at God because I want to be something, and I of myself am nothing. In the valley, we discover that part of self, a false sense of self, a personal sense of self that we are still hanging on to, we're still clinging to, or maybe even still enjoying. Let me see if I can find something here. I'll be right back. I hope you will consider this in good taste. It comes from The Spiritual Journey of Joel S. Goldsmith, a book by Lorraine Sinclair, in which she puts out several letters of Joel's. Here's one that he wrote to God, my love offering to God, and it was in 1952. That would have been 3 years before the Kahlua study series, but it would have been 5 years after he started teaching. And, of course, he had healed thousands and thousands of people. And I want you to see that even Joel Goldsmith, whom I'm pretty sure everyone has up on a pedestal, he suffered from a personal sense of self until, as he reports in 63, he went through the crucifixion and ascension. So I want you to see you're not alone if you find yourself in some of these valleys. So here is his letter to God. Now bear in mind, he has healed thousands of people. Several books have gone out, and he has taught classes around the world. Yet he's alone, and he writes to God. He says, "This past night has been a continuation of nightmares. For weeks now, weeks, my soul has jumped back and forth between hope and despair, joy and anguish, doubt and confidence. But last night came the hell of the realization of separation from God." You see, he has no conscious awareness of God, and there's nothing worse than that once you've had it. "Today all ties with this world are broken. Today all concern for persons and events is gone. All hope of good here is departed, and I look forward to the unknown with a light heart." You see where he's surrendering a personal sense and personal wishes and personal hopes, personal ties? He continues with, "This is the end of the road. From 1928 to 1952, I really tried. I tried. My life, my work, everything went into what I believed was a search for God and God's work. It is 24 years, almost to the day, to the month, and it has been a failure." Now, he's not feeling a failure because there was no healings, because we know there were thousands, or because there were no classes, because there was hundreds. He's feeling a failure because he's momentarily lost a conscious awareness of God, which means everything to him. He's in that valley in a personal sense of self. He says, "Oh yes, a glorious failure, one not to be ashamed of. This work is a failure only after 24 years of having honestly, earnestly, faithfully lived up to the highest I knew or was capable of. 24 years of giving to the fight days and nights as complete a sacrifice of personal interest as has been possible. So if failure, I can at least glory in it. There are no regrets. Since my best went into it, I cannot feel that had I done so and so, it might have been different. Up to my understanding and capacity, I gave it all, and I failed. So my failure is my triumph. I glory in a great failure. And if a failure it must be, I rejoice, for it is a grand and noble failure. I know now that when men are sad and down over their failure, somewhere they know they did not give their utmost all. But I have given my utmost all, so I can joy and rejoice in my failure. Having nothing left to place at his feet, here it is. Take my failure. It is the only perfect thing I have to offer up. Take it, Father. A beautiful, perfect failure. A bright and shining failure. It is all I have, and it is yours. Your son, Joel." Now, 1928 to 1952. 24 years, almost a quarter of a century. And yet, he is feeling in the valley a complete and total failure, which is really all that a personal sense of self can feel. You see, he says that we can attain the presence of God almost at will, and yet he's finding not completely at will. There are periods still when he feels a that the conscious awareness of God is missing. There are periods when he does not feel that presence. And they're hell. And I can tell you the truth, that when I had my spiritual experience in which I felt God inside of everyone and everything, it lasted for 30 days. And then I came back to everyday consciousness, and it was hell. It was hell on earth to not have as intense a relationship or awareness or conscious awareness of God as I had before. It took some adjusting. And then I found, like Joel did, there were mountaintop experiences, and then there were valleys, mountaintops and valleys. And let's hear what he says about this. He says, as the journey continues, the mountain experiences will be of longer duration and the valley experiences shorter. This will go on year after year until a point of transition is reached, when the heights remain his permanent dwelling place. Now, if you look, and I was curious, so I looked when this book was published, and it was published in 1956. It was published 4 years after that letter he wrote in 1952. So at some point there must have been a transition, or he would not be writing. A point of transition is reached when the heights remain his permanent dwelling place. Then, he says, the human sense of life will never again touch us so deeply. We shall never again be able to hate or love quite so intensely as before. We shall neither grieve nor rejoice with the same intensity of human emotion. The depth of our vision will continue to bring forth greater and greater spiritual light, wisdom, and guidance, so that every day will be a day of deeper discernment, a day of greater living in the atmosphere of God than the preceding day. So, there is a point of transition in going through these valley experiences and casting off the personal sense of self and whatever attachments still remain. We walk closer and closer to that point in which we make the transition and humanhood has died. And now the conscious awareness of living life as a beholder, watching Christ live itself where we stand, watching Christ stand, this becomes a permanent dwelling place. And that's why we're all walking. So he says, in this work, we are at that place in consciousness where the Christ must be experienced. For years we have talked and heard about the beauty of the Christ, the power of the Christ, and the healing influence of the Christ, that Spirit of the Lord within us. The time has come when we should no longer depend upon talk or upon the illumination of some other person. We must have this experience for ourselves so that we can be in the world but not of it, walk up and down this world and not be a part of it, walk in and out of the discords and in harmonies as well as the pleasures and harmonies, and through it all maintain our spiritual integrity. You see, the valleys and the mountains are the same. You walk in and out of them and yet maintain your spiritual integrity. The darkness and the light are both alike to thee. You have made the transition in which you maintain your spiritual integrity. He says, then we lose all sense of having to do something, or having to know something, or even having to understand something. See, a spiritual experience, the conscious awareness of God, is not dependent upon your understanding. Get that through your head. God is not dependent on your understanding. It was while I was trying to understand God That was just a delay tactic by a personal sense of self. Oh yes, let me see if I can come to an intellectual understanding of the infinite. And then when I get that intellectual understanding, I'll surrender and I'll let God take over. And so that prevented me from ever reaching the point of surrender. Until finally in exasperation and frustration, okay, I'll never know God. I surrender. God, Father, reveal yourself. And then it became a living experience. And then I understood. So the understanding follows the spiritual experience. It doesn't precede it. If you're waiting for understanding, you're wasting your time. So, we do not have to do something, know something, or understand something. We have to die. We have to live life as a beholder, and he's going to get into that now. Some people have had an experience of God, but no outer transformation resulted. They merely lived in the memory of it. However, a student who has devoted his life to the study of spiritual wisdom and the practice of meditation finds that when the God experience does come, he's not bewildered because he understands its meaning. Although he accepts it with joy as an evidence of grace, he knows that it has been attained by the expenditure of much time and effort. Therefore, he does not live in outworn memories because, as receptivity increases through continued meditation, remember, he's not really into hour and 2 hour long meditations, he's into 12 2-minute meditations. As receptivity increases through continued meditation, the God experience will become more frequent. The day comes when it can be attained at will. Now, he wrote this 4 years after his experience of feeling like a failure. This spiritual presence and power, this Christ, which takes over the functions of life for us, is invisible, but nonetheless real for all its invisibility. It takes over the functions of the body so that it becomes unnecessary to take thought. Gradually, as the Christ lives our life, the awareness of a physical body or bodily activities is eliminated. You see, health is of God, he says. There's not my health or your health. If we accept this principle literally, we shall see miracles. Health is really a quality and an activity of God, the essence and substance of God. In this spiritual way of life, there is only one health, and that is God. Once we learn to give up the sense of personal possession, as indicated by the words I, me, and mine, we begin to find the real meaning of spiritual life, spiritual living, which is universal, impersonal, harmonious living. So, what is he saying on this page? He's saying, again, the real culprit, the enemy, is within. There's no enemy out there. No illusion is ever externalized. The enemy is this belief that you have a personal life, personal health, personal supply, personal companions. Yes, like that belief I had that I would have a personal marriage. All of these beliefs have to be surrendered down there in the valley. And you can either have one cataclysmic experience, as the Buddha did under the Bodhi tree, or you can come to it gradually by experiences of mountaintops and experiences of valleys. And in the valleys is where you will surrender the personal sense of self and the different ways that it tries to function, and the different beliefs and universal beliefs that you've accepted, like my health, my supply, my companion. Now, when you do that, not as an intellectual exercise, sitting down and thinking, well, yes, I guess it really is God's supply since God made everything. Oh, nonsense. That's just an intellectual gobbledygook. But when you come into it through meditation, through standing aside and seeing God function your health, God function your supply, God, not your supply, your health, God function God's supply, God function God's health, God function God's companionship. When you stand aside as and you look as a beholder and see God functioning itself, then you have the inner experience which lifts you up onto the next mountain and you behold God living itself. You have the conscious awareness of God. So he says, when you have that, he says, with the spiritual sense of health comes the discovery that health is not dependent on the functioning of any organ of the body. Health is dependent on God alone. So, that's a promise. In this chapter, there are a lot of promises. When you do this, that will happen. When you do this, that will happen. When you do this, that will happen. And that's how you know you're doing this, because that is happening. You don't have to ask someone, how am I doing? Look and see, is this happening? Are you becoming consciously aware of God living itself? Are you becoming consciously aware that health's not dependent on the body, health's dependent on God alone? Are you becoming a beholder? If you are, then you're headed the right way. If you aren't, you're due for some more valley experiences. So he says, let us, that's you and I, be beholders of God, appearing as our health, our wealth, our strength, and our life. That's what we need to be. He said it in several of his writings. Be a beholder. But it must be a conscious awareness experience, it's an inner attitude, an inner letting go. It's an inner surrender of personal sense of self. It starts in your meditation. There's that click in which you let go for a moment. It may just be a nanosecond. But perhaps now, with practice, you have learned to stop, and the experience has lasted for a minute or two. So that's where it starts, in your meditation. But eventually you're able to open your eyes and maintain that same attitude, watching, beholding, witnessing, bearing witness to God living itself. And then some miraculous things begin to happen through you, but you know it's not you. And if you begin to think it's you, you're headed for another valley. They will continue until the heights become your permanent dwelling place. So he says, so it is with every phase of our experience. If there is a sense of rightness about it, if the right words are spoken at the right time, the right acts are performed at the right time, if harmony prevails in our experience, then we feel, we see, we recognize. Every phase of that experience is a direct result of the activity of the Christ. We do not do it. We do not take thought. It, the Christ, does it all. The presence goes before us to make the crooked places straight and to prepare a place for us. The presence does everything for us, and we live on this plane of existence as witnesses, beholders. Where do we live that? Right here, on this plane. Do you want heaven here and now? Live life as a beholder. Now, he says, there are innumerable biblical passages which reveal the importance of waiting on the Lord, being a beholder of life. But this does not mean sitting idly by doing nothing. On the contrary, the more one waits on the Lord, the more is one a beholder of God working in him, through him, and as him, and the more active does he become. Now, I've seen this. I have seen this where people are attempting to practice this spiritual principle of being a beholder, a witness, bearing witness to God in action, and they just sort of sit and do nothing. Well, I haven't been directed yet. I'm not hearing this still small voice, but I don't want to be living on self-will either, so I'll just do nothing. I'll sit here. But that's a clear indication that they're not following the principle. It's still a personal sense of self trying to be spiritual. And it doesn't work. So they end up broke, because if you don't work and you do nothing, you end up broke. And usually the companion leaves them. You know? Companion doesn't want somebody that's just going to leech off of them. And here is this person just leeching off of their companion. Well, I'm not doing anything because God hasn't directed me. Yes, that's because you haven't yet learned to be a beholder, first in your meditation. You don't leave your spouse or leave your job or leave your present mode of life. Remember last week he said, we don't leave any of these things until the Spirit itself picks us up and moves us. Now, you sitting in a chair not doing anything, leeching off of your spouse, does not mean that you're living a spiritual way of life or the Spirit has moved you. So here's how he puts it. He says, if we are beholders, we do those things which require our attention and which lie nearest at hand. If we have a household to take care of, we take care of it. If we are entrusted with a business to manage, we manage it. But while we are engaging in these activities, it is with the attitude, I wait on the Lord. I behold what the Father gives me to do. Always, we hold ourselves in such a state of receptivity that we are ready and willing at a moment's notice to change any plans we may have made in order to follow the divine plan. So you see, being a beholder does not mean making changes out here. Being a beholder is an inner experience. And you begin it right where you are. You don't make changes out here to try to be spiritual. That's putting a Band-Aid on an open sore. It won't work. That's trying to... What's that old expression? Putting lipstick on a pig and trying to make her look beautiful? Or painting over something and trying to make it look nice? No, that's not it. You start where you are. Start where you are. It's an inner experience. First in your meditation, and then while you're walking around, you learn to live life as a beholder. I used to work in a factory. When I first discovered how to do this, I was working in a factory. I was building digital magnetic tape drives, reel-to-reel. For computers, whenever you see big mainframes and you see rows and rows of reel-to-reel tape decks above the servers, well, you can know that I built some of those. And so while I was working in the factory, I was reading this book and I was thinking, how do I become a beholder? And so I discovered that, well, I made a little game out of it. There was a big clock hanging on the wall in the factory. There was probably over 100 of us working there. And I looked at the clock and I tried once an hour to remember God. And sometimes I would go into the bathroom where nobody could see me and be quiet for a minute or two. Sometimes I would just take a breath and inside myself say, Father, thy will be done. It's your ball game. It's your show. What do you want to do? And I would look and there would be work in front of me to do. And I tell you, some amazing things happened. Amazing things. I set the record, and I'm not telling you how great I am, okay? I'm telling you how great this thing is when you become a beholder. I set the record for building these tape decks faster than anybody ever had. You were given a week to build 20 of them, and I built 20 of them in a day and a half. The inspector came and checked them all out, and they all passed. The plant manager came and told me to slow down. But anyway, that was just fun in the early days of living life as a beholder, and I learned I could do it right on the job there, right there. And then that, of course, lifted me into other things and other things and other things. Eventually, I went back to college, got a degree in counseling, started working with people, and so on and so forth. And let me tell you, this works pretty good. When you're running a group, I used to do group therapy, and I was the facilitator. And before the group would come there, I would have a meditation and step aside, let Christ live itself. And then it was amazing how often I could look around that room and know the person to call on and know exactly what it was that they needed to work on. It was amazing. It was completely spiritually intuitive. There was not a thinking process involved. Okay, but anyway, that's another story. What I'm saying and the point that I'm making is we do those things which require our attention and lie nearest at hand. We do not leave our spouse and try to go to the Himalayas and live in a cave. We do not leave our job. We do not leave our neighborhood. We stand right where we are. And then doors will open of themselves. I had a man call me while I was working at that factory and offer me a job as a supervisor of a assembly department in another factory, and I took it. That led to something else. That led to something else. That led to something else. Okay? And, of course, today we're making these talks. Now, and we're working also with foster children that have special needs. Okay, now, getting back to this. If we are beholders, we do those things which require our attention and lie nearest at hand. But while we are engaging in these activities, it is with the attitude, I wait on the Lord, I behold what the Father gives me to do. See, inside ourselves, we create a state of receptivity. He says, in being a beholder, we discover that there is a divine direction, a divine power which guides us. This is the state of consciousness achieved by Paul. I live, yet not I. Christ liveth in me. It is as if the man Paul were stepping to one side, saying, the Christ is on the field, the Christ is acting in me, through me, and as me. Christ lives my life for me. That is the attitude that we maintain as a beholder. So there it is. If you want to know how you maintain an attitude of receptivity, look at this paragraph and become this. Don't know the words, don't memorize it, and it will do you no good. Go within yourself and develop this attitude. Try it first in meditation. Then when you feel the movement and begin to experience Christ is on the field there, then start to do it with your eyes open. When you're on the job, when you're at the dinner table, when you're walking, when you're mowing the yard, when you're shopping at the supermarket, when you're driving your car even. That is the attitude that we maintain as a beholder. I am not really living my life at all. I am watching the Father live its life through me. This is the ideal way of living. This is the spiritual way of life. There is always a presence, the infinite invisible, which goes before us to make the crooked places straight and to make every detail of our experience perfect. Now, this is true, and it's true today. Yesterday was a Saturday. Most things were closed. Most businesses were closed around here in the Appalachian Mountains. And I came upstairs here, and the air conditioner was no longer working. It was very hot upstairs in the summer. A hot box. And I didn't know where to go. There were several choices. I could drive two towns over and go to a hardware store like Lowe's or Home Depot and try to get an air conditioner, but I'm not strong enough to lift that up myself and bring it up this flight of stairs. Okay? And I know that there's some insulation that needs to be put in around it, and I know that hooked up a hose to the old one so it took the moisture out of the air and dripped it into the grass instead of on my deck outside the sliding door here. Well, there were several choices, and as I drove to town, I said exactly this, Father, let me know what your decision is. And then I got quiet. I was tempted to put on the radio to put on some music, and I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. I can't be receptive if I'm listening to that. So I left it off. I drove to town. We have a little town here, but there is an Ace Hardware. I went there. They had the exact right air conditioner with the exact same measurements, so I knew it would fit in the wall. We don't have a window unit. We have a wall unit. And I brought it home, and I was able to carry it all the way upstairs here. And then my wife's son came over lifted it up and put it in the wall, because it's up kind of high. And then together we got it done. And so it turned out that it wasn't a big deal after all. I think it was like $300. And I'm sitting here today making this talk, and I'm perfectly fine. It's 70 degrees up here. It's nice. Instead of 90 or 95. In the middle of the afternoon, it can get to be 110 degrees up here. That's hot, with thick, muggy air, without that air conditioner. So, the point I'm making is this. I live this way. This is the way I live. I am not really living my life at all. I am watching the Father live its life through me. This is the ideal way of living. This is the spiritual way of life. And that's the way I live. And that's the way you should live. It's an attitude inside of yourself. It's not a memorization or an intellectual understanding. It's an actual dying to self, to a personal self, and watching the impersonal live. Our entire experience of frustration comes from our reluctance to wait long enough for it to take over. Most of us are unwilling to wait until the moment in which a decision is necessary. We insist on knowing the answer in advance. Oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you, when I went into the hardware shop to buy the air conditioner, their computers were down, so they couldn't scan my debit card, and I didn't have cash, and yet they let me come home with an air conditioner, with the only stipulation was that they have my phone number. I'm sure I'll hear from them tomorrow, which is Monday, and I'll give them all the details and we'll settle up. But these kind of things happen, things that would not normally happen as you stand aside and watch the Father living itself. He says here, we want to know what is around the corner. We want to know today what is going to happen next week, next month, or even what decision should be made for next year, instead of waiting until the actual moment when the decision is required, and then letting God put the words in our mouth and reveal what action should be taken. See, day by day the manna falls. Day by day. But it doesn't fall if you just have an intellectual understanding. It only falls if you've learned the second part of meditation, that of waiting upon the Lord. That's why it's so vital to move away from an intellectual understanding, from the letter, to the actual spirit of truth. He says, oh, and by the way, I have written here in the margin, how to be a human, how not to be a beholder. We have acquired the habit of impatience, and the result is that instead of waiting for God's decision to be made manifest, we let fear creep in. And then, afraid of the possible unfortunate effects of indecision, we rush in and act on the basis of our best human judgment. Now, there is a perfect example of the opposite of not being a beholder. There's a perfect example of being human, of humanhood. This is the part that must die, this rushing in on the basis of our own best human judgment. Yuck. Okay, so in spiritual living, we do not depend upon our correct human evaluation of situations. No, we're no longer depending on our mind, our thoughts, our emotions, our humanhood, even our beliefs, or even our ideals. regardless of how good our judgment may seem to be, we turn away from it and turn to the Father. Father, show me when to move. Show me whether or not to take the next step and when to take it. Says Joel, with patience and with practice, we develop the consciousness of a beholder. So here's how you develop the consciousness of a beholder. Of waiting on the Lord, which leads us to the miracle of life. Now, he's going to mention miracle three times, I noticed, and I went back to see what the miracle really is. It leads us to the miracle of life in which we discover not only that there is a God, but that it has become the governing factor in our life. It has taken over our experience. So the miracle of life, according to Joel, is to discover, to become consciously aware of God taking over your experience. We have prevented the activity and operation of God in our affairs by not waiting, by not being a beholder, by not sitting to one side until we feel that the Father is taking over. If only we would do that, we would find the miracle, and there's the second time, the miracle of a divine presence going before us to make all things new. Again, the miracle of life, according to Joel, is becoming consciously aware of a divine presence going before us. When we make a decision, we find insurmountable obstacles. But when God makes the decision, God goes before us and removes every obstacle. Everything necessary to facilitate the undertaking is provided. So, let us make a daily practice of being a beholder. Father, this is your day, the day you have made. I will be glad and rejoice in it. Reveal to me the work of this day. Show me thy decisions, not mine, but thine. Let thy will alone be the motivating and activating principle of my life. On the next page is the secret. Let us be willing to wait until the very second before a decision must be made. Even if it is a minute later than necessary, we wait and wait. Let us be patient, very patient. It will come. And once we have had this experience, we shall have witnessed the miracle of watching God operating in our affairs. There's that word miracle again. And the miracle is what? The conscious awareness of God operating in our affairs. See that? That's the biggest miracle. That's the miracle you can expect from following the Infinite Way principles. That's the miracle you can expect from... That's the miracle promised you if you will go into your meditation and stop. And there in your meditation, become aware or discover the movement of an impersonal presence. And then, with your eyes open, learning to wait until the very second before a decision must be made, even if it is a minute later, to wait, to wait. And if you are patient, it will happen with eyes open. You will have the miracle of the conscious awareness of God operating in your affairs. There is the promise of the Infinite Way. Once you are consciously aware in your meditation of this presence, and then with eyes open learn to wait until you're consciously aware of it living itself, then you have... Well, then you are the Infinite Way. You are the Infinite Way living itself. When this awareness has become an actual experience, we shall never again know what it is to be without a conscious awareness of God's government, because we shall have discovered God does respond. God does take over. In other words, you will have a spiritual awakening. In the 23rd Psalm, we read that we are to dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of our life, all days, forever. and forever. Now, dwelling in the house means dwelling in the conscious awareness, the consciousness of the presence of God forever and ever. Here at the bottom of the page, he says there is a limit to what the human mind and body can accomplish in 24 hours. But there is no limit to what the Christ can perform through a human being in 24 hours. The Christ does not measure its activity in terms of your individual capacity. No, the Christ operates through its capacity, for which we are but the instruments. Everyone has the full capacity of the Godhead, in proportion to the stillness and quietness of the thinking, reasoning mind, does infinity flow through into expression. So, again, in the valley you give up a reliance on thinking, reasoning mind, and you come into what? You come into a state of beholding God live itself. And that state of beholding is the mind which was in Christ Jesus. What was he doing? He told you, I myself am nothing. I'm beholding the Father within. He doeth the works. Any inspiration received from God carries with it fulfillment. Yes, when I received the inspiration this morning, whispered in my ear, I heard the fruit of the Spirit. And I turned to that chapter, and yes, now that felt right. And here is the fulfillment of that, this talk. All right, so he says, nobody could earnestly follow for any length of time the instruction and meditation as set forth in this book without noticing a change of a radical spiritual nature. Because from the moment that there is a turning away from material reliances, and that includes a reliance on yourself, on your human self, to an invisible, humanly unknown way of life, it is inevitable that this change will follow. The fruit of the Spirit is love. This is real love, real joy, peace, real peace, my peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. You see, the law of Moses is for a humanhood to have somewhat of a harmonious life. But we're leaving humanhood behind. We're coming into Christhood, in which we live life as a beholder. And the law cannot function against that Christ, because Christ brings grace. Years of consecration and devotion, in which one has in some measure left all for Christ, must precede the harvesting of this fruit. And so you must have gone through these valley experiences in which you shuck off the personal sense of self and all of its attachments and beliefs. Then you come into life as a beholder, and you become consciously aware of God, of Spirit, first in your meditation, and then living itself where you stand. Christ liveth. When that time comes, we shall never again be alone. We shall never again fear. We may get through the valley of the shadow of death, but even there the presence is with us. We rest in the center of our being while the storms pass overhead. We are beholders of God, guiding, maintaining, and sustaining its own. God fulfilling itself as individual being. Then we see him as he is, and God appears as the wholeness, the abundance, the harmony, the peace, and the joy of our experience. So we find that here in the third book that Joel recommends for the beginner is the exact instruction for the advanced student. Each book, I am finding as I go back and review it again, has instructions for the beginner, has instructions for the intermediary, and has instructions for the advanced student. Well, interestingly enough, I look and it's exactly 1 hour. So Spirit was right. This was the exact chapter that we were to review. Now, I hope you see that throughout all the works and throughout all the writings of the Infinite Way, that the Spirit of Christ was coming through Joel and teaching us how to attain it as our own living experience. First, in moments of meditation in which we lose self and feel an inner movement of Spirit of Christ, and then later, with eyes open, bearing witness to God in action, and then finally a point of transition in which the mountaintops become our permanent dwelling place, and though we are still aware of the valley as far as passing experiences of good and evil, they no longer affect us here on the mountaintop of Christ consciousness, because we have found a permanent state of being consciously aware that Christ liveth itself. Thank you so much. Happy journey to you. I'm always willing to read a real email, whether it's one where you express you're struggling with something, that perhaps I can give you a hint, or whether it's one with you just sharing your joyful, peaceful experiences. I find those very uplifting too. And of course, you know you can reach me at iamwithin@gmail.com, and on the website mysticalprinciples.com, at the bottom, if you will scroll down, is my address if you choose to write a letter. Okay, God bless, my friends.